Sorry.
Perfect.
Okay, is that all
Anyway,
right?
no, you can
Okay.
continue.
Right. So with dark matter, I think the exciting part of it is that, yes, we still don't understand entirely what it is or where it is, but that's also the nice part of it in that there's a lot of science that we can still do in terms of figuring out what it is and where it is. So one of the ways we can do that is with strong lensing
So we can
and
turn to
yes.
the, so we can either slide down the chair then
Oh no, okay.
problem, sorry.
I love Zoom very much. It's been a great couple of years doing a PhD. Let me get these back full
No.
screen, maybe. There we go. Right. So just skipping over that.
Perfect.
Everything is okay now, no
Yes.
worry.
Tell
Okay,
me about
cool.
it.
No problem. It's totally fine. So as for strong lensing, I have a movie which is of course not gonna play, I don't think, because that's just how things are going. But I'm assuming that everyone is sort of like mostly familiar with this. But basically strong lensing is what happens, or rather, strong lensing is a consequence of the theory of general relativity that's from Einstein. So basically, space-time is a big mass sheet, and if you dump a big massive object into that sheet, then it will distort the sheets, and light that's traveling from a background source to us as it passes through, the distortion generated by that massive object will end up traveling in multiple different paths, and that will create multiple images within the field of view. Relative to us. And so basically, by finding where that distortion happens and finding these square multiple images, we can get a sense of the exact distribution of mass that's responsible for causing the strong lensing effect in the first place. So examples of that, of course, are this galaxy lens. So this is just an Einstein ring where one blue galaxy has been stretched out along this region of magnification here. And then in a cluster, which is where I'm interested in, this is ABEL-378 on the right. You can see an example of this in this sort of stretched out object near the south half of the image. All right. So this is strong lensing. And now I'll show you this image that was on the title slide of my talk. This is the galaxy cluster ABEL-383. Because I work in strong lensing, I get to look at a lot of pretty pictures every day. So I'm contractually obligated to also show you pretty pictures every so often. So ABEL-383 is a nice cluster. It's at a redshift of 0.187. It has been observed pretty well before, modeled before. But the reason I'm interested in it is not necessarily because of this nice little green arc down here. This is strong lensing as well, but because of this wisp of emission that's kind of sticking out of the BCG. And you see it super well in this image. But if I kind of zoom in here in an HST and then a Gelfit model here, you can see that there is definitely this little beam of light. And this is also a strongly lensed multiple image of a background galaxy, but it shows up very close to the center of the BCG. Also, just to note on this, with ABEL-383, this BCG is elongated along the line of sight, but this is a dust lane, and then this is just the two parts of the BCG, but it's all one thing, in case that's a little bit confusing. Regardless, I'm looking at these radial arcs because they are quite rare to be found in nature, just because the geometry required to generate them is very precise. And also, when they do show up, they're often masked out by the light of the BCG, so you can't see them if they are there. So finding these is quite nice for several reasons, but specifically, with strong gravitational lensing, we use the positions of multiply imaged galaxies as constraints on our mass distribution. So I'm looking at the inner dark matter density profile of galaxy clusters. So having a constraint near the innermost part of the cluster is going to be helpful for that. Right. So then why do I care about the this inner profile? And the reason for that is because of this concept that's called the core cusp tension. This is something that you've maybe heard applied to dwarf galaxies, but this is a problem in physics that exists on all scales all the way up to galaxy clusters. And this is basically an issue that arises between observations and simulations for CDM. So with CDM simulations that have been conducted recently, including ones with baryons, so the dark matter density profile that they predict inside the center of these objects rises up in more of a cusp. Whereas with observations, what happens is usually people are observing more core-like behavior. So in an effort to sort of examine this and attempt to get closer to a resolution, not solving this problem, I want to be clear, I'm sort of, as an observationalist, contributing more data points to this issue so that we can kind of get a better sense of what's going on, at least on the observational side, and how we can sort of see what's happening in nature. So in order to do that, the specific data points that I'm looking at are galaxy clusters with radial arcs. I've selected six clusters. I've shown four here because these are the clusters that I've made models for. The other two are coming from Mathilde and from Mathilde's student Joseph Allingham. Of these four clusters, all of them have these radial arcs. I've kind of given you some postage stamp snapshots here so you can see sort of where they are, what they look like. All of these clusters are pretty relaxed with a nearly circular BCG, and that means that they're good to compare with simulations. So I'm trying to make things as non-complicated as possible on the observational side. The reason I'm looking at these six in particular is because they've all been observed in the Kaleidoscope MU survey. And Kaleidoscope is a program undertaken by Alistair Edge up at Durham. And it's basically a big survey of about 150 clusters. They are non-priority observations, and they're about 1 hour exposure time each. So it's a lot of data, but it's not necessarily the deepest data. However, all that MUSE data is very useful for basically these two reasons in my project. So first, MUSE detects spectroscopic redshifts for all of these radial arcs, which is great. And then it also gives us measurements for the stellar velocity diversion of the BCG. And I'll talk about that next, or in a minute rather. But first, just as an introduction to MUSE, I don't know if anyone is unfamiliar with it. Just briefly, MUSE is a multi-unit spectroscopic explorer, and it's on the VLT in Chile. It's an IFU with about a 1 arc minute field of view, which makes it really nice for strong lensing. And I'll show you a visual of that in a moment. And again, this kaleidoscope survey is what I am sort of basing my selection out of. And yes, they are these sort of shallow observations. As far as what we can get out of MUSE for this particular project, I just have sort of a loose histogram here of all the sources that we're getting, with background objects being the most numerous, cluster members being in the middle, and then foreground objects, which we don't really care about, on the left. As far as detections, we are, again, getting spectroscopic redshifts for all of these radial arcs and for a lot of the lens sources, which is great for bringing down our lens model systematics. Cluster member detections are also useful for the same reason. They're particularly helpful for one of my clusters, which only has limited HST data available in the archive right now. And then, yes, so MUSE is very helpful for strong lensing. As far as lensing, of course, since I'm here to work with Eric and Marceau, I'm using LensTool. So LensTool, just briefly, is this parametric MCMC modeling software, and it uses this for the positions and positions and redshifts of multiple image arcs as constraints in order to solve for the mass distribution of the cluster. And I parametrize that mass distribution with three separate components. First is the cluster scale, dark matter halo. Second are galaxy scale dark matter halos that I put on perturbers, basically. So individual galaxies that are having more of a local effect on the strong lensing. And then the cluster galaxies that are scaled to the Baker-Jackson relation. And basically, it solves this little geometric equation here and then gives me out a result for where all of the mass of the cluster is. So what that ends up looking like in practice is over here on the right, and I've plotted the MUSE field of view in this orange box. So you can see that MUSE is really covering basically the entirety of the strong lensing region, which is super nice. All of the white numbers are the multiply image galaxies, background galaxies that I'm using as constraints in the model. And then the red line is sort of showing you where a lot of the mass responsible for the strong lensing is enclosed in. Right. So at this point, I am again looking at this inner dark matter density profile of galaxy clusters. LensTool can do that. But what I am trying to do in this project is sort of maximize the information that I'm putting into my model so that I can be confident in my results, I guess. So Lenstol struggles to break the degeneracy between baryonic mass and cluster dark matter inside this inner region. So inside like this 50 kilocrysic region, because of course the BCG dominates. So in order to sort of help break this degeneracy, I'm adding a fourth component into my model, which is basically constructed by modeling the BCG separately using 2D stellar kinematics out of MUSE. And stellar kinematics and then HSC photometry are both things that I'm applying in order to constrain this sort of BCG mass. So then I can put the BCG mass together with the cluster mass and get a sense of the split between those in the inner part of the cluster so that I can actually look at this density profile in more detail. So I start with stellar kinematics, because again, I'm looking at that and photometry in order to constrain this BCG mass so that I can probe the distribution, the total mass between the stellar dominated and the dark matter affected areas. So in order to use these kinematics, I'm using the penalized pixel fitting software algorithm written by Capillary. This is constructed using the IndoUS stellar template library. It's basically taking a spectra and matching it to a bunch of templates from stars. And the main thing that I want to talk about here is that, again, I'm looking at this these MUSE cubes taken from the Kaleidoscope survey. And this survey is great, but it's not deep. So one of the concerns that we had was whether or not we could actually extract measurements for the velocity dispersion profile. Velocity dispersion is something I'm using to constrain the mass of the BCG, which I will talk about later. But in order to get good measurements of the velocity dispersion profile, we wanted to see if we could actually measure that effectively with our shallow MUSE cubes. So I tried a couple of things in order to improve my signal to noise of my fitting. And those things are basically these two questions. So essentially, does changing the type of aperture used to extract our spectra change our fit? And then can we still get this accurate measurement of the velocity dispersion from a MUSE cube? And the first question was prompted by a discussion that we had at Durham, which was basically what would happen if we put a line slit on top of the MUSE cube? What will that measurement end up looking like? So in order to investigate that first question, I ended up experimenting with four different kinds of apertures here. So standard, just circular cutout, and then a circular annulus, the full slit, and then a cut slit. So cut slit with like the middle of it cut out. I binned all of these so that the signal to noise was greater than 30 in the full spectrum, and then plotted the velocity dispersion profile for each. So because the BCG is embedded in the cluster scale dark, or the cluster dark matter halo, as you step out in radius, the velocity dispersion profile should increase. This is behavior that ends up getting reproduced very well with the circular annulus and not so well with the other three. So because I have this noisy MUSE cube, basically I'm maximizing the amount of good information inside of my extraction while minimizing the amount of noise. So the circular annulus ended up working out well for this sort of analysis. So that's what I went with as far as aperture extraction. And then I looked at this question of whether or not we can actually model this velocity dispersion profile effectively with these shallow cubes. And so to do that, because I am lucky enough to also be working on Buffalo a little bit, or rather be involved with Mathilde, who is doing Buffalo, I took the MUSE cube observations from Buffalo for ABLE 370. And those are about 8 hours. And then I had David Lagatuta, who is my other co-supervisor at Durham, help me to reduce that 8 hour exposure into a 1 hour exposure. So we simulated basically the difference between a deep cube, so the normal 8 hours, and then the shallow cube, which was a 1 hour exposure. And then I did this same extraction on the BCG and ended up getting a velocity dispersion profile that agrees out to about 15 kiloparsecs before it starts going crazy. This is still the region of interest for us. So this is worth doing, I think. Also, it's important to note that between the deep and the shallow cube here, the shallow cube is like the worst case scenario. So even in the worst case scenario, we're still getting data that agrees within the region that we're most interested in looking at. So then, of course, what does that actually look like in practice? So one of the papers that I've based a lot of my work one of the papers that I've based my work off of is written by Andrew Neiman in 2013, where he also looked at these density profiles in clusters. And he did a similar velocity dispersion measurement using Keck, and his Keck exposures are around 8 hours. So I wanted to see how my velocity dispersion profile for ABLE-383, which I showed you at the beginning, stacks up against his Keck exposures. And so his profile is in red and mine is in gray, and they agree pretty well in this area, again, that we're interested in. So this was great to find and a nice result. So I don't know if this is necessarily a surprising result for these two questions, in that the answer is yes to both of them, but it was still nice to confirm that, I guess. So at this point, the second thing that I'm doing is combining the kinematics of the BCG with some photometric information. And the photometry itself is not super unique, I guess. I'm basically modeling every single BCG using GALFIT, taking those parameters to get elliptical isopodes, and then extracting the surface brightness across a, 20 kiloparsec region, and then using that to fit the surface brightness profile. The specific profile form that I'm using is this DPIE. So this is relying on this sort of R-core, R-cut, and the scaling. I'm using a DPIE because this is convenient to put into LensTool. And it's also just something that ends up working out fairly nicely in general. Right. So now the question is essentially how to combine all of this information that I've just gotten about the BCG into LensTool in a way that makes sense. And so the way that I'm doing this is by minimizing this chi-squared. And this chi-squared relies on the observed velocity dispersion, which I've already found from my clusters using MUSE, or this one, and then the model velocity dispersion. And so I'm calculating that model velocity dispersion basically with this equation up here. And this relies on the 2D surface brightness, the 3D surface brightness, the total enclosed mass, and then all of these. Importantly, this equation and what I'm showing you next are made with the assumption of no anisotropy. So I'm assuming spheres. Anisotropy is something that I am still working on, but because these are BCGs for the most part, there isn't a whole lot of crazy dynamics happening in them. So no anisotropy is like generally a pretty safe assumption to make, but this is still a test that I'm going to run to see how much of an effect that will have. So with my photometric fits and the BCG mass and then cluster scale total mass, I can calculate this quantity and get this chi-squared, and then combine this with the chi-squared on the right, which is just minimizing inside of LensTool the distance between the predicted position for the multiply imaged objects, which again are used as constraints, and then the actual positions that we give the model. So now we come to the density profiles, which is perhaps the actual exciting part of the talk. So they end up looking something like this. The important thing that I want to emphasize here is that I'm only using strong lensing and I'm only using stellar kinematics. So my profile is pretty okay as far as errors inside of this region that's constrained by strong lensing. So here is the radial arc really close to the center of the cluster, and then the furthest arc is out here. And then after that, my errors start to balloon out because I'm not using any kind of weak lensing or anything to constrain this outer mass distribution. But here, which is where we're interested in sort of this 5 to 50 kiloparsec region, it's pretty okay. To kind of demonstrate that a little bit better, I have just this overlay. So this shows you like where LensTool is doing a lot of work, and then where BCG kinematics is doing a lot of work. And then sort of this is where they're overlapping. This is like super rough. Please don't actually quote me on numbers. I sort of did this in PowerPoint, but just to give you sort of a visual example of what's going on there. So then at this point, I can talk a little bit about the actual slope measurements that I'm getting. These are preliminary still, but they're still worth presenting, I think, at this point. So I'm calculating this slope with this equation up here. I'm looking at this region between about 5 and 50 kiloparsecs. Inside of 5 kiloparsecs, the BCG profile is dominating. And outside of 50 kiloparsecs, the dark matter is dominating. So I'm interested in this interplay, which is why I'm looking at this region specifically. So again, I'm constructing these slope measurements using this minimized chi-squared from the kinematics and from Lunstall. And I end up getting this kind of distribution here. I get a mean slope value for about 0.63 for all of my clusters at the moment. And this is consistent with observations that sort of predict also this pore-like behavior. So I'm looking at this cusp pore tension, and I have found, at least with radial arcs, that the slope is also pretty cored. And this is consistent with that Newman 2013 paper, where they found kind of a mean value of about 0.54 for seven different clusters. Two of them have these radial arcs and the other five didn't. So I think that's kind of an interesting takeaway. But again, I'm not making any super exciting claims here. This is, again, kind of throwing data points at the problem in order to see maybe what's happening. But having only like six clusters isn't enough to do a whole lot of statistics. So in that sense, I'm interested in expanding this, maybe in the future, to more clusters inside of the kaleidoscope survey, specifically to look at clusters without radial arcs. I mentioned at the beginning that the geometric precision that's required inside of just the alignment between the background galaxy, the cluster, and us is very precise. And basically, radial arcs only show up when this profile is a little bit flatter anyway, theoretically. So this is kind of confirming that. So our observations match theory in this case. But I am curious to see whether we can replicate this kind of analysis with strong lensing and kinematics only without any radial arcs. So without this constraint very close to the center of the cluster. Maybe this will be possible, maybe it won't be, but it will be interesting to find out. I'm also curious about actually incorporating weak lensing into some of these. The requirement for that is kind of better HST data than is available for these clusters. So maybe we be a little bit more picky about how we select our next sample. But overall, the takeaway, the two things, I guess, that I hope you can take away from this talk are first that radial arc or galaxy clusters with radial arcs in them end up having more cored density profile slopes. And then the second thing is basically that this kind of analysis is possible with strong lensing and with MUSE, which means that we can do kind of good science cheaply. So we don't need like super long exposures on Keck. We can kind of just go in with MUSE and get reasonably good quality data and then do this kind of work. So that's promising, I think, for the future, because again, if we're looking to obtain more data points, we need to be able to kind of speed this up and do it a little bit more efficiently. So Kaleidoscope will hopefully help with that. And I think that should be time. So thank you very much for listening, and I can take questions.
Very basic question. You draw the same conclusion by just using the distance dispersion measurements on the fact that there's a core possibly at the center of the space frame. In terms of, I mean, because from what I understand, the constraint you get in the core region comes mainly from the distance dispersion.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering what's if just with the velocity version, you could have just said something, or maybe you still need to also have a larger scale to be consistent with them.
I think it's important to have lensing still, because the velocity dispersion stops being relevant around 15 to 20 as far as the actual impact on the profile. And the lensing mass starts to be very important around that same region. So I think to have one without the other, you can still maybe say something, but it's not as good as putting them both together. And in the case that there is strong lensing, it's pretty free to do that for like lens tool, for example. So there's no reason not to.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have quite some scatter, you know,
yes.
in the estimate of the scope.
Yeah.
So do you can you correlate the scatter of each different cluster with the properties of the cluster? Did you look at that?
Yeah, yeah. So I think the one that's the worst is definitely this one, right? This is Max 1427. This is the cluster that I mentioned only has one HST band available. So some of this is why this also wasn't final, because I'm still doing a little bit of experimenting with this. But basically, if I increase this radius a bit, not the radius, the area that I'm cutting out the slope over, I can increase that bit a little bit more and make it converge around here. But this is not something I'm comfortable doing yet, which is why I've kind of left it here, because I need to think about the theory of that and whether it would be appropriate to do that.
And the one that was 326, which has a very high probability of being exposed.
Yes. So this one, I have this here. So 0326 is actually this one. So the density profile is super flat. So this is just, I think, a logical takeaway from just looking at it side by side.
It has some peculiar observation.
326 has two radial arcs in it, actually. So I think perhaps that means it's a little bit flatter than anything else. If the BCG is here, then the radial arc is here, and then there's another one here, and they're two separate systems. So,
right. Mm-hmm.
So it means that you're going to read some of them.
Possibly, because there are two more there. But I think with 326, I would want a little bit better, some more HST data to really be confident of saying that.
Mm-hmm. So what do you assume for the stellar mass light ratio of the BCG?
The stellar mass light ratio is something that I'm calculating using SPS fitting with the Chabry IMF. This is maybe something that...
So it's not a free parameter?
No. Well, technically it is. I'm using the velocity dispersion of the BCG inside of lens tool as a proxy for this, but I'm putting priors on it based on my fit with photometry. I took this equation out of my slide. Yeah, this is something that I was interested in experimenting with.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. That is potentially something that will shift it based on previous literature, specifically Andrew Newman's 2013 B paper. It will not change it that heavily. But this is still something that I need to test out a little bit just to make sure that I'm okay with making these kinds of measurements. Yeah. Again, preliminary.
Mm-hmm. I'm a bit puzzled by this picture of the probability density of the slope. What does it mean? You take the mean, and this mean is excluded by four of your six clusters. Does it mean that there is no universal slope for clusters, or that the error bars are not representative of what they should be?
I think as far as what the distribution actually means, these are all constructed out of weighted, how to say this? Lens Tool is an MCMC software for every completed model that I have 5,000 different possible runs for the mass distribution as calculated in Lens Tool. I'm calculating the velocity dispersion constraint, the chi-squared for that, after Lens Tool is done running. So then I get another set of weights and I apply those together and then we get something like this. As far as the universal part of cluster density profiles, I think it's safe to say based on literature, there is no such thing, but I'm not obviously gonna claim that necessarily. I think this is perhaps something that you could say, but it's not something I'm going to assert. Or spread, I mean, this just means that some of these clusters are running a little bit better inside of these parameter spaces than others. But again, this is something that I'm working on tightening up so that I can get something converging for this one and then maybe for this one too, just doing something to help with this edge.
So the two set of constraints from the velocity dispersion and from the strong lensing are independent?
Yes.
And then you multiply them here?
Yes.
Oh, I'm not doing a joint fit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not doing the joint fit in your case. Just multiply the PDF.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe you lack correlations between the two, and that will explain why it's sharper than it should be.
It is a possibility, yeah. One of the things I was thinking about trying to do is calculate this chi-squared for the velocity dispersion as lens tool is running, but I have to do some work on my code before it's able to be done that way. So for now, this is what I have, but definitely it can be improved.
Yeah, I mean, for sure it's good.
Yeah.
I think that would be done independent.
So as far as I understand it, the area corresponds to the 1 sigma.
Mm-hmm.
So would it be, if there's any probability to constrain a bit better the, at the longer distances?
Sorry.
From the...
Yes.
sorry, my English.
No, it's know. Okay. I'm sorry. I can't speak French.
You know, the errors mm-hmm. Are much larger at larger distances.
Mm-hmm.
So would it be worth to try to constrain better this, that the error bars gets less, or is it possible or not?
Yes, it is possible to because tighten up the error bars.
I guess it's, I mean, this the slope at the largest distance
mm-hmm.
must be correlated also to the what are the expectations to try to constrain better on this large distances?
So strong lensing and kinematics alone are really only going to be effective inside of this region, but out here, this is where you would want to apply something like weak lensing. But weak lensing requires you to have good HST observations, which is not necessarily something I have for these clusters. I have sort of shallow snap program filters. So that's something I am interested in exploring, though, in sort of a follow-up to this, selecting clusters that do have this HST information available and actually doing that weak lensing analysis so that I can see what sort of effect that does have.
So with the strong lensing, you cannot constrain better at larger distances.
Mm-hmm.
Only you have to go to other weak lensing. Mm-hmm.
They are part of different systems?
These clusters, no. They're just selected based on their presence in the kaleidoscope survey. So if they have reuse, then I can look at them.
So Albert 370 has some, I don't remember which one of the BCG has a way back. But why doesn't
So ABLE 370 is just something I looked at in order to test this velocity dispersion profile. It's not part of the analysis that I did just because it's already been modeled and everything has been done already. So I don't necessarily have too much more to contribute in that area. So in that sense, ABLE 370 is kind of my mock simulation using observational data of whether or not this would even be possible.
So for these, you made all your own lens models using multiple images in the 1 hour news exposures, or use pre-published?
So for finding the constraints, I did that using a combination of both news and HST. So in HST, we use color and morphology to sort of determine whether or not a system is the same, so the same multiple image background source. And then I went in with Muse and actually looked at the spectroscopic redshifts, and then if they all aligned up and they look the same and also HST, then those are probably going to be multiple images.
Yeah, but for each, you did all that yourself. There's no pre-published.
I did everything myself first, and then I went back and checked through literature for the two clusters that have been modeled before, and made sure that they agreed, and you know, all my numbering is the same as those papers as well. So I will say for all of these clusters, I'm getting at least one new system out of Muse that has not been published before. Just out of Muse, yeah. It's super good at picking up these radial arcs, I guess, or not radial arcs. Yes, radial arcs, but also like multiple image sources. Muse excels at that.
Which lens did you use for the dispersion?
I anchored it around the iron 5270 for the most part, because that's been used for a lot of kinematic studies in the past. So seems like a good.
I just use the one line.
I'm using the whole spectrum, but I kind of anchored it on the iron 5270 in the sense that if my signal to noise ratio in this whole spectrum and in that region wasn't good enough, then I rejected that bin and increased the size until I got something that happened for both.
Yeah.
Any question online, maybe? I don't see any, so I think we can thanks the speaker again.
Thank you again for coming out on a Friday afternoon. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.